A San Francisco designer was sitting at his home office sipping a cup of coffee. Every sip is a minute break from the long hours of writing the script for the course he was about to record. He was in the middle of a six-month break from client work, and the month without a salary were beginning to take their toll. As he moved closer and closer to the launch date, his bank account continued to empty, but no matter how stressful it got, his commitment to deliver the highest quality never wavered. Well, that launch day eventually came, and the designer was rewarded for his work. His course was quickly considered one of the greatest resources for designers to learn Sketch and improve their skills.
Hello, hackers. Thanks a lot for joining us for another episode of the Hacking UI podcast, where we hack our way through design, development, and entrepreneurship. I'm David Tintner.
And I'm Sagi Schreiber.
Our guest today is a super talented designer with an entrepreneurial fire burning in his veins. He's currently splitting his time between doing amazing and diverse design work for high-end clients and running Sketchmaster, his scaling platform of professional training courses for Sketch. We met him in San Francisco and felt we had to get him on the podcast.
Ladies and gents, it's our pleasure to present to you, Peter Noel.
Let's get hacking.
So, welcome everybody, and today David and I are here with Peter Noel. Peter, what's up?
How's it going, guys?
Hey, Peter.
How's it going? All good. Great to have you here, man. And it's been a few weeks since we met in San Francisco. And I'm so happy that we now got this episode going. So first, you know, for the ones that don't know you, maybe you can start about giving a bit of background about yourself.
Sure. Yeah. So my name is Peter Noel, and I'm a designer in San Francisco. I've been a freelance designer for the last 4 years, and a lot of people will know me for the articles that I've written about Sketch or the training courses that I've made about Sketch. On most of those are on Medium, and yeah, I've done quite a bit of freelance work in many different design areas, but most people will probably know me for my online content.
Yeah, and so yeah, I certainly know you from your content, and you've written great articles. So just first of all, we put them in the show notes for anybody who wants to get to them. But before we dig into the articles themselves, so right now you're a freelancer. That's what you're doing most of the time or all the time? Or
well, so now actually my time is split almost 50-50 or 60-40 between working on my Sketch courses, making new courses, keeping it running, talking with customers, making improvements to the existing material, keeping it up to date, and taking on one or two freelance projects as well. So rather than kind of having one main thing, I've kind of split my time about 3 days and 2 days for those two different kind of, in a way, two different businesses.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so like, what do you say it takes more, the courses right now or the freelance?
Right now, it's a bit more of the courses. It's incredibly time consuming to write these and to create them. It's very laborious to do it really well. And well, I'd say I also find it really helpful to section off my projects in specific days, so I know exactly which days every week I'm working with a client or on a client's project, and it's not like a couple hours here, a couple hours there. It's especially for the creative work that I suppose for my own creative process, I get the most out of having long blocks of time where I can just spend a day or most of a day focusing on writing a script or creating a new design. And I need those big chunks of time.
Yeah, I think.
Yeah, I completely understand. I'm the same way too. Sagi and I are always talking about trying to batch our work and try to get things done in big blocks like that. Because you're absolutely right. For the creative process, it's really, really difficult to get into it, for me at least. And it takes me probably half an hour to an hour until I'm in the zone. And then when I'm in the zone, I don't want to be disturbed at all. Once I'm there, once I get to that spot, I can go for, you know, hours on end, but it takes a while.
We're in this age now where like the world doesn't care when you're in that zone and like you're still going to be tweeted at and all of that stuff. And so like you just kind of have to turn off notifications and dedicate your time to something. Or at least that's what I've found to be the most kind of constructive for myself.
Yeah, totally. And you know, the thing is that these days when you don't respond to, I don't know, even Twitter messages sometimes, you're like, you come off as a dick. You know, it's like, oh, you didn't respond to my Twitter message. And like, I don't understand this. It's like, it's attacking from all sides, Messenger, WhatsApp, Twitter.
And everybody feels bad, but it's kind of funny. Like, I'd say maybe half the emails that I receive and probably send as well, start with, "I'm sorry about the delay." It's like this kind of etiquette that like nobody can keep up, but we all still feel bad for ourselves, or like we all still berate ourselves.
Definitely. Definitely agree with you on that one. So can you give us, all right, so you're freelancing and you're splitting your time between the course right now. So yeah. On the freelance side, how many clients are you working with, or what kind of jobs are you doing?
Right. So right now I'm working on a pretty big branding and web design project, and that's my main client right now. In the past, when I've been doing full-time freelance, I've had 3 to 4 clients at a time. And again, I still find it really helpful to break them up by full days if possible. So like 3 days a week on this project, 2 days a week on that project. And then I kind of have I have some very easy calculations about my week, right? Okay. It's pretty clear that my week is full and I don't have space for another client if I've already committed 3 days to one and 2 days to another. But some of the times that I've, in the last few years, that I've enjoyed the most are when I have had a few different clients in different areas. So for example, like there was one time, there's a local juice company in San Francisco called Juice Shop. And I did most of their design work, and it spanned everything from web to packaging and print to typography and type design.
I loved it, by the way.
Thanks, Agi. Yeah, and also quite a bit of physical signage. So some of my favorite times were, you know, working on like a big laser engraved wooden sign one day, and then the next day, a contract job for Apple, designing icons, and that is completely digital, or submitting code that was going to be on Apple.com, which is just like, I mean, I get giddy even thinking about it, because that is for me the most exciting part. Like, that's the most exciting that my job can get. When I can do a few different things that kind of stimulate different parts of my brain and get paid to do all of those.
I definitely understand that one. Yeah, so I was going to say, on that same subject of stimulating your brain from kind of a few different ways, is that how you got into your side project? Or can you talk to us a little bit about that transition from doing freelance to working on the course so much of your time?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's interesting. About a year ago, I started to transition out of my client relationships because I knew that I wanted to create these courses. I had been to a couple meetups. I had met a number of other sketch users, and I was starting to realize that there was a noticeable lack of professional training for this tool. And, you know, Sketch is a pretty new piece of software, but it's already being used in very professional contexts. It's being used by, you know, most of the top companies to design products that millions and millions of people use. So it seemed kind of like, all right, these 1 hour basics courses that are starting to come out and may or may not be produced very well, those don't cut it anymore. And I've been using Sketch since about 2012. So at this point, it's a little over 4 years. And just found myself in a position where I had already used it for many different types of projects, even print projects. And that I simply, by having used this tool for a while, had a lot of those professional workflows to share with people. So I decided, you know what, if these courses need to be made and I can make it, I'm going to try and clear off my schedule. And so right around January, February, I had a completely empty schedule. But it wasn't, I wasn't, you know, goofing off all day. I really tried to stay disciplined and spent about 5 or 6 months creating the courses. So it's kind of funny. And in a lot of ways, it was a side project. And I thought about it as a side project for a while. But I had to approach it for at least some period of time as my main project. And now it's kind of half, it's a half project, you know?
That's really interesting. Okay. Do you think it would have been possible to do something of this, of like such a high caliber like you did, if it was a side project, or was it something that really needed complete full-time dedication?
So I see maybe a lot of the articles that I've written as side projects. They're considerable in kind of how comprehensive they are on a given topic. And, you know, I make a bunch of custom graphics for them and really try to make sure that they're an extremely helpful, practical, definitive resource for whatever topic they're on. Those take many days of writing, and you know, in the last few years, it hasn't been, you know, that has been a side project. So that was maybe like I was able to spend a few hours one morning working on that, or, you know, an hour in the evening. To me, that's a side project, and it works pretty well for those little chunks, like those little one piece articles. But as soon as I knew that I wanted to commit to creating something that was really, really like the best training videos that I'd ever seen, because I'm just a huge perfectionist, and I knew that if I did it, I was going to make sure that I did it really well. That was a bigger undertaking. And I actually didn't realize how big an undertaking it was. But, you know, again, probably largely due to my perfectionist personality, I just couldn't stop until it was great. So, you know, I do think that if you're going to do something that you expect to really represent you, and that it's going to be more than what you can do in, I don't know, a week's worth of evenings, it probably makes sense to block off a little bit of time on your schedule that is like really dedicated time, not just evening time or an hour in the morning, because that's the way that you show yourself that you care about it. And if, you know, if you're like me, you get your best work done when you've got those long blocks of time. And also when you are able to recharge on the weekend, or, you know, cook yourself a nice meal in the evening and not be constantly stretching yourself too thin.
Yeah, totally. And I think that what you did here, it kind of applies. So for anyone who's hearing the show and thinking about opening a side project or has a side project and wants to do something bigger, you know, like a course or something like that, then I really believe in those batching the hours thing, theory. Like, you have to batch your hours because, yeah, you're doing something big and you need to focus for it. Mm-hmm. So also, people that are working full-time jobs, do you have any tips for them, you know, batching those hours, or like how they can get about
it? Yeah, it's interesting. Some people, you know, I'm even myself, I might not say that I have a full-time job, but I certainly spend more than 40 hours a week working. So yeah. I do have a full-time job. It's just not with an employer. It's not W-2, which actually I'm just realizing is a reference to the American like tax filing form. So I don't have an employer, but I couldn't say exactly for somebody in a full-time job. It's just been a while since I've worked for a company. So I'm not sure if I have a lot of advice, but I would say that honestly, maybe the best advice I could give is don't worry about like having a side project. If you are really putting yourself out in a full-time job, at least 40 hours a week. I mean, it's up to you, but I think that there's almost a sort of obsession with having a side project, as though like that's what makes you an interesting person, and that's like where you're actually going to do your best work. And I would really fight that, because if you're working a 40 hour a week job and you aren't able to do your best work, we're talking about, it is a privilege to be able to make money from what you do, and I want to acknowledge that, but you should also probably question whether or not those 40 hours are really what you should be doing. Well, I think that if, yeah,
I think that's a really good point what you say. But I think for a lot of people, I know that I think I felt this way, that a side project can be that way. If you realize that the 40-hour week job is not what you want to be doing, a side project can be the way to help you transition out of that. And there still will be that time when you're kind of caught in the middle.
Absolutely.
Know, for whatever financial reasons, or maybe just, you know, you're not quite sure if the side project you're working on is what you want to do full time. Maybe it can be a way to get your feet wet and not just, you know, swap 40 hours a week on something you don't like with 40 hours a week on something else you don't like.
No, absolutely. I would say still my biggest piece of advice is being very defensive about your time and not trying to kill yourself by working just 16 hour days every single day. I mean, I've spent quite a bit of time doing that, and it's really not sustainable for very long. So the extent to which anybody can block off like maybe one great, quiet, isolated day in their week to focus on that side project, or block off a 3-hour period of time in the evening that they just like, maybe they get back from work a little early. It's like, there isn't going to be any more time. So you just have to be like more defensive of the time that you do have. And, you know, something that we all say a lot and that I'm constantly learning and relearning is to just be better at saying no. And it's one of the things that I'm most excited about my schedule right now is that I have two things that I'm doing and no more. I'm working on my courses 3 days a week, and I'm working on a new client project that I'm really excited about 2 days a week, and that's it. And I know I'll probably work a little more on the weekends or whatever, but basically, it's very clear cut. And I can't overemphasize how helpful it is, I really psychologically, to just have things that clear cut.
Mm-hmm. I definitely hear. But I have to ask you, Peter, I think that a lot of the question that a lot of people have now, because you know what you said is great advice about managing your time. But a lot of people out there are probably saying, okay, I would also love to, you know, just stop working as a freelancer for a few weeks and go all in on my side project. But how did how were you practically able to do that? Was it you saved up money enough money before to do it? Were you making money during it? Or it was just this was an investment that you chose to take on and you said, I'm going all in. Can you give like some tips on that?
Yeah, absolutely. So I was able to take that time and really invest my time and my money into that 5 or 6 months where I was not making any money. I saved up beforehand and I used up just about all the money I have and I've been, or just about all the money that I had. I've been able to replenish my bank account a little bit and that's good. I'm in a more stable place now, but you know, it's, that gets me back to really deciding to do things that you really believe in. Because if I was not willing, I wasn't going to go raise somebody else's money. I wasn't going to go raise, I mean, the reality is for a small business, even raising 10, 20, 50, 100K, which sounds like pennies in Silicon Valley, where like, you know, your seed round is at least $500,000. Like, that's a lot of money. That's somebody else's money. And for me, like, I knew that putting my own money into it and to keep me going was probably one of the best ways of making sure that I was doing what I really cared about doing and that I stayed on track because I was only accountable to myself.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess I kind of forgot your question, but, no, but that seemed like an important part of the answer.
That's a great point. And I really like what you said there about not wanting to raise money. I think I know Sigi and I had a lot of conversations about this too with Hacking UI, and we really that really is something we agree with as well. So on that note, I want to ask you, you know, is this something, now that the course and everything seems to be very successful, is that something that you're considering going forward? Are you looking to hire people or to grow it? Or is it something that you always want to continue working on yourself?
Well, actually, yeah. So let's get to that in a sec. I just thought of one other thing that I wanted to say on the last question, which was that inevitably, if any of the listeners are like me, we bite off more than we can chew. And you know, originally I wanted to create like a full comprehensive beginner to advanced course that went through maybe like 8 different design projects, included every single feature in Sketch. And that's still my plan. I've designed a lot of those demo projects that will become the centerpieces of future courses. But some of the best advice, some of the toughest to swallow advice that I got in the process of making them was that I wasn't ever going to complete it if the scope was that huge. So I just started to break each of the courses, or I broke the courses into each of those projects, and each was about, you know, 1 hour to 2 hours. And suddenly I was just like, okay, I'm going to release the first 2 projects, which I've already written. And it became so much more manageable because I knew that, oh, I could release this in a couple months, as opposed to, well, I have no idea, but at the current rate, it's going to be at least another 6 or 8 months. And, you know, I couldn't have afforded that. So breaking things up into smaller chunks and trying to release little bits of it and start making money, because again, it's like you have to be accountable to yourself. You have to do things in a smart way that might not be the most ideal way. So I was able to start making money after about 5 or 6 months instead of maybe never. Like, who knows? Like, the project could have just been too big, and now it's out. And it has, and it is sustaining itself, and it's sustaining me enough to create future courses. So breaking things up into little bits and trying to get them out there and ideally start making money for you as you continue building out your whole vision. Like, that's a really important part of the process, and it can be difficult to swallow if you're like me.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, that's awesome. And I want to follow up on that. But just before I do that, I want us to take a quick break and give a shout out to our sponsors for this episode. Hey guys, I want to tell you about our sponsor, InEventApart, because they have some of the best conferences for both designers and front-end developers. And if you haven't attended one yet, you're really missing out. The events are extremely professional and always cover the most cutting-edge technology and latest developments. And they bring in the best speakers and biggest names in the industry every single time. I'm talking legends like Eric Meyer, Jeffrey Zeldman, Rachel Andrew, Brad Frost, Dan Moll. You get the picture. But it's not just about the talks. They do an incredible job of making the conference social and encouraging people to meet and network. If you've been to these kind of conferences before, you know that designers and developers aren't always, let's say, the most social crowd. But at an Events Apart, they take special care to make sure it's fun, inviting, and that there's never a boring moment. They host 7 or so events per year in cities all across the US, so you can find the one that's most convenient for you. The tickets are also extremely affordable for a 2 or 3 day event like this, and we can make it even better. You'll get $100 off any event if you use the code AEAHacking at checkout. Go to aneventapart.com/HUI. And use the code AEAHacking. Yeah, and so I was just curious before you had mentioned that you didn't want to raise money and that you took like this investment. So I was just curious if that's how you continue on want to go with the company and with the courses.
Yeah, so it's interesting. I've had oh my gosh, I start everything with it's interesting. I guess I'm reflecting on this process, and I've had a few people give me advice or who I've asked advice from. After having launched the courses, like, what should I turn this into? And some of the most helpful advice has really just been spinning that question back at me, asking, well, what do you want this to be? Like, what do you want this to, what role do you want this to have in your life? Because to be honest, I could turn this into a far more lucrative business by taking it in a couple other directions. But right now, I'm not interested in hiring a bunch of people and turning this into some like massive empire of design training. That's just not what I want it to be for myself. And I know that I, in order to do that, I would have to be then in kind of a managerial role where I am managing people. And I've had other people come on to help me, and that's very helpful. It's more occasional. It's more short-term contract help, whether it's marketing related or producing the courses, post-production, things like that. Oh, and I have a developer who works with me once a week who helps add new features to the platform. Not that I couldn't, but because I'm stretched very thin. And people ultimately want me. This was kind of this moment of realization that sounds very silly in retrospect, but people want me to make new content. People want me to design a great platform and make new courses and new articles. That's why they started following me. That's why they are following me. And that's really the main expectation there. So if I wanted to build this into something where I had employees and that was really, I kind of jokingly say that it would be like a design training empire. I do think that is possible, but it wouldn't allow me to do what I do best. And it would be so much more than I kind of want this to be in my life, which is something that I care about, but that is not 100% of my professional work. So I guess in response to your question, there can often be pressure to create a project, maybe like release an MVP or something, and then scale it and hire employees and like just like have some sort of exponential growth. But I think it's also okay to have something that is not exponential, but that is steady and is a very considerate part of your professional work, of your life, and that helps you with your personal goals. So for example, I can make money if I go travel because people will still buy my courses while I'm away. And that's incredible. That's a huge personal gain that I get from this. And I don't need it to be some big empire that's going to need me around, 60 hours a week just to manage it, just in order to feel happy about that.
Yeah, I really dig what you're saying. And it's also something that we teach in the Side Project Accelerator. We say that whatever people right now wanting to do side projects and, even make them scale those in the future, but always
make the decisions based on freedom. So what you're saying, you can go travel and people will still buy your courses. That's a decision based on freedom. Not scaling it, it's a decision based on freedom. Like the way I see it, right? I mean, that's what you're shooting for. You're shooting for your free time. You're shooting for experiences in life. You're shooting for, you know, just enjoying life, not just like working.
Or even when it comes to working, the freedom to decide what to work on.
Exactly. And I think, you know, I still see myself very much as a designer. Even though most of this year I have, or you know, the majority of this year, I've been a trainer or a writer. And and it's very important to me that I always have one foot firmly in creating design projects, even if the other foot is in, you know, something that uses different skill sets like writing or training. So yeah, I guess, David, what you were saying with like, yeah, like what you want your professional work to be. Like, I always want to make sure that I stay connected with practicing design.
Definitely.
Cool. So what I would like to get into is just go a bit back before the course and actually also, I mean, still right now. So what you were doing, and I remember we talked about it in San Francisco. So you had written articles on Medium, gained a following, and then you launched a product to that following, which we call audience-driven product development. And that's something we find as a common pattern between successful solopreneurs or internet, like entrepreneurs, whatever you want to call it, that we're doing. But so I want to talk to you about how you gained that following, how you gained your audience, because obviously it was on Medium. It was not with your own blog. You do not have CTAs all over the place to sign up for your mailing list. So, so I want to talk to you about your views. I think they're very unique. You gain, you have about like 12,000 followers on Medium, which is amazing. You have way over 1,000 likes on every one of your Medium articles, which is crazy. I mean, I think mine is like the maximum is like 90. I don't know. It's like,
So tell us, what did you do exactly?
So guys, there's a magic formula. Don't you know it? Like the whole thing for me is that I just write something when I feel like I have something meaningful to contribute. And each of those followers, and you know, it's the numbers are far less if you look at Twitter or, you know, any of the these other services. Like I just don't, I haven't made it a priority to grow an online audience. But what around my articles, it is kind of very naturally, very organically grown. I think that rather than having gained those followers, I've really earned those followers by simply focusing on writing very practical, very helpful and meaningful, and I would also add like well-designed, intentionally created articles occasionally, not with like a strategy, not with a set schedule, like I'm going to release one every month. And I'd probably be 20 times where I am now if I did have one of those strategies, but that's not what has mattered most to me. And, you know, yeah, so part of the reason that I obviously created my courses was because I knew that so many people were reading my articles and so many people were interested in these topics. And, you know, it, just as you say, like, wow, like it's incredible. I would see Medium articles where I'm like, how the hell did they get that many people to like recommend their article? Or like how many, like that is just crazy. There's some crazy numbers that far exceed my articles. And I was always 100% of the articles that I have published, I'm just blown away that that many people even care about this stuff. It's like, I am just going to release the most nerdy, the most like just niche esoteric design technical article, and I don't expect more than, I don't know, a couple hundred people to even read it. And then and it's like pixel density or like how Bezier curves work. I mean, who cares about that stuff? I mean, like, I seriously, it blows me away how many people
obviously
as apparently nerdy. you found the what the audience wants.
So I had a friend stop me in a conversation recently, and he pointed this out as the impetus behind everything that I've created, whether it's an article or a course. And I said simply, I just wish somebody had told me this when I was learning. And there was a section in my first article about Sketch that was called like What I Wish Somebody Had Told Me. And it was about this like strange path direction issue that Sketch had and how to fix it. And it's like it plagued everybody. And then one day, miraculously, I discovered why it happened and how to fix it. And everybody, it was like, that was why people shared it so much and why people started following me, was because I started to share what simply I wish somebody had told me. And I don't share something unless I have that to offer. In that sense, I'm a little bit old school and a little bit contrary to a lot of the marketing advice that swirls around these days.
But that's great. I mean, you solved your own problem and then shared it with the world. And I think we can also really relate to that. The way we actually launched Hacking UI was, I remember every day Sagi would come in and bitch and complain about how he couldn't export SVGs from Photoshop. This was like, you know, 3 or 4 years ago, before Photoshop CC or anything. And then we built a script that did it, and then we shared it. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I totally relate, you know, to you solving your own problem, and then that's what you're sharing with people.
Yeah, I mean, I would also say that you are right in that I probably could not have launched my courses to much success had I not had that following. And it's not a huge following, you know, especially on Twitter, but it's like, it's just enough of a following that, you know, folks like you, other friends in the design and the tech world that I've met, were able to check it out and say, hey, this is very quality. And, you know, they have, you know, sometimes 40 times the following that I have. And it's like just enough following to get it out there. And it wasn't an explosive launch. It wasn't like, oh my gosh, I just like, I can retire now or something. It didn't, you know, it didn't pay for itself instantly on launch day, but there was enough momentum to carry it forward.
I guess it's also a very specific audience too. Like you said, you know, you're writing very, very technical, in-depth articles that if the mm-hmm. people are following them or recommending them to others, then it must be people who really care about the subject.
Yeah. You know, the funniest thing too is like, I do not claim to be the expert on most of this stuff. When I released an article and video about pixel density or about Bezier curves, I always have people who are far smarter than me responding, saying, well, actually, you know, blah, 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 blah with the math. And it's like, okay, so, you know, I wish I had access to you. I wish I knew you when I was writing this. And sometimes I go back and I try and edit something, but it's miraculous. Like, there are a lot of far smarter people out there, and most of them aren't sharing their, like, in a their very knowledge. Practical way, at least, a lot of these workflows or techniques or, you know, simply their knowledge. Yeah. And they're probably, you know, spending all their time working on something very important. But I have found that I'm kind of, you know, maybe it's just where I am in my career, but I'm just technical enough that I can understand that stuff, but still very grounded in training and talking with people and writing a lot, that I love to learn something and then explain it even better. So I try to be more like a bridge with what I create than trying to say, hey, I'm the expert, here's the definitive end all piece.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're authentic. It's good.
Well, you know, it's funny too, though, like online, we all think that these people who are posting something are just like the experts. And it's like, oh my gosh, like you wrote this thing or like you made this thing. And we're all just like normal people. Like Sagi, you know, I knew you and Hacking UI long before we just met recently in San Francisco, but we just went to like a grocery market and ate a casual lunch together, and you know, we're just like normal people. So it's always kind of funny, like this impression that we get of people being so much greater than they are. We're all just like normal people, kind of humble, just sharing little things.
Yeah. Anyway, and totally related to that, and also want to add on top of that that I had the same kind of experience when I reached out for people for my podcast, like design managers from the Bay Area. Like I was like, "Who am I? Yeah. I'm this little guy from Israel, from Tel Aviv." And those are like, you know, biggest design managers, or Airbnb and Facebook and all. And they were like, "Hey, no problem. Let's, you know, let's talk." And they were like, really cool, and they're real people, and you know, and we talked, and we, you know, we had jokes going back and forth. It was just like a So everyone is a person and anyone is reachable. So just like anybody hearing this, you should know that everyone is also reachable and everyone is a human being and would like a nice conversation to meet other cool people. So, yeah. All right. So going back to Medium, just like a mm-hmm. few more questions about that. First of all, are you going to have a mailing list sometime, or have you ever thought of this like an option for growing?
I started a mailing list relatively recently, and it's still a small list. I just have a very small text link at the bottom of my articles, but it's, you know, it's something that I send out maybe once a month. It's pretty occasional, just whenever I am speaking at an event or I've released a new article, some sort of news. I try not to force myself onto a schedule, but instead to share things when I have something to share. Yeah, I mean, for me, a newsletter is a way simply of spreading the word on something, because, you know, for me, I'm not putting out articles or courses very frequently. I spend a lot of time working on a few things. And so when I release something, I really want people to see it because I've put a ton of energy into it. And these days, you know, Twitter, for example, it's great for sharing frequent content. But a lot of people, unless it starts to be picked up by a lot of other users and like retweeted and all, a lot of people will completely miss some big project that I've just released simply because like in this age of social media where we don't have a great messaging, I don't know, we don't have great message means of spreading, how should I say this?
Well, I think there's a lot of noise, and it's hard to get through the noise and find the good stuff.
There's a lot of noise, and also you miss people. Mm-hmm. So with email, the way that I see it is that's just my way of having a greater likelihood that people who care about what I make will see it. And it's not something that I spend a lot of time on. It's not something that I try to make any money off of. I think an email newsletter can be many things for many people. And for me, it's just a way for sharing the news when I have an important project to share with people who really want to know about it. Yeah. Quite simply. Yeah.
No, it makes sense. I mean,
it just gets lost any other way.
Yeah.
And it still gets lost in email, you know, like, you know, half the people or something will not even open it or see it.
Yeah.
So in addition to the email that you said you're just starting to get into now, do you do anything else to promote your articles or to promote your work outside of like after you've published something on Medium, do you promote it somewhere?
I share it with my newsletter. I share it on social media. I try to notify maybe a few people who I think are going to be really interested in it, or a few people, like, you know, for example, I might shoot something over to you guys and say like, hey, check this out. You might find it useful, or, you know, if it is something sketch related, I'll send it to their team. And I know that they generally like to include that in their own newsletter, which is infinitely larger than my own. Mm-hmm. And it's more of a way of, rather than having like a big promotional push, it's like, okay, we all know these days, like how hard it is to just notify people of something that they are going to enjoy reading or watching. And so I'll try to reach out to a few people directly who I think are going to get something out of it or enjoy sharing it with their specific audience. But I don't do a huge marketing or like promotional push. I kind of do a few things and then cross my fingers and then try to get on with my next project. Mm-hmm.
All right.
I'm not a very fierce marketer.
All right. And one last question. Are you going to have a blog of your own one day, or are you going to keep writing on Medium as a strategy?
I'm not sure if I have the answer to that. I definitely see both sides of the argument. And for me, writing articles on Medium allows me to publish these individual pieces that very, very much stand on their own, as opposed to feeling like there's a commitment to consistency or a commitment of frequency. So, you know, I haven't written an article I just had one published. I don't know. It's like, I can write one every month. I can write one every 2 or 3 months. And And I think people are generally okay with that. And on Medium, they really stand alone. I also like that on Medium, many more people find it because I'm not, like I said, I'm not avidly trying to like grow my newsletter, or I'm not avidly trying to grow my follower base. And so the extent to which Medium can just kind of naturally help me with that, help me get my content in front of people who want to read it, that's really helpful. I have enough people coming to my own website and to Sketchmaster for my courses that I don't feel myself needing to have a blog on those. But I think that you can go both ways. I think that Medium works really well if you don't want to like maintain a blog as one of your main projects, because it will be a project. You know, it's like I can, with Medium articles, I can make each little one a kind of a side project, you could say. But
yeah,
a blog is a big undertaking and people expect you to continually update it. And then what if you want to like write some content that isn't going to be on that, like that cannot be on your blog? It's for a magazine or some other publication. For me, it's a little bit more flexible and it opens me up to a few more options when I use Medium.
Okay, cool. I find it really interesting, by the way, the fact that you're not like most bloggers or solopreneurs. Even in a way, we are different because David and I know we're all about like optimizing. Like, we saw that, you know, last article we wrote, we posted it on our Reddit and this subreddit. And so next time we're going to do it again.
Yeah.
And you know what? We found out like, we put the course of the SAP Project Accelerator on. So we're going to update all the landing pages that we possibly can in our website that to have a message about it. And we're like, okay, let's optimize. And like, in terms of like optimization of our audience, one thing that is the most important to us is our mailing list. And mm-hmm. from that, we derive the thing that we need a website of our own, because then we control where we have sign-up boxes. Right. Where in Medium you can't have basically a sign-up box, you just right. have to, you know, kind of. So, and you're the exact opposite. You're like, guys, leave me, you know, take that aside. I don't need this on my head right now. I just want to provide value, and the value actually does bring you tons of audience, and it's really inspiring, I think, for me.
Yeah, it's funny. I had this period of time after I released the courses. It was about 3 or 4 months ago. And it was right after I was able to kind of get a few good nights of sleep and answer a bunch of launch-related emails and requests. And it was kind of like, okay, what now? Well, I know I have more courses. Oh, but there are like a bunch of promotional things I can do. Oh, there's a bunch of marketing-related stuff I can do. There's a bunch of optimization I can do. For example, I know what the conversion rate is between the amount of people who land on sketchmaster.com and who generally, like in a given week, and how many people purchase a course that same week. And I could have focused on optimizing that. And for a long time, I was really stressing out about doing that. And I was making little changes. And I hired a marketing person to help me with a number of other little tasks. And, you know, we spent a lot of time setting up analytics and all sorts of stuff and trying to optimize our funnel and all this. Like this is important maybe for a company that has a product and a small team. So it could make sense for a startup, for example. But for me, I'm just one person and I didn't really want to spend so much of my time focusing on optimization when it wasn't what makes me happy. And also when at the end of the day, like I said earlier, people expect me to be making new content. So now I kind of have a couple focuses. There are a couple interesting partnerships for, you know, organizations that can use these courses for their students or for their employees or whatever. So a few of those partnerships are very useful for me to focus on. And then improving the current courses, I'm pushing out updates just about every week to either the website or the courses themselves. And I'm so happy to be doing that and to work on new courses. And it's funny, I felt this huge weight lift off of me when I had a friend and an advisor tell me, you know what, just don't focus on optimization right now. You can do that later. You can do that once you've accomplished a bit more of your goal towards making more courses, but you're not there yet and you don't need to stress out about it. So I don't want to belittle the importance or the value or the impact that you can have by focusing on optimization. But for me, right now, it just wasn't the right thing. And it's so funny, like overnight, I was a far happier person. That might just have been like my personality. I might have been getting, you know, misaligned with what makes me tick.
Yeah, no, it's very interesting. So cool. And now that we're talking a lot about the course, if you may, I would like to get into the course itself.
Yeah.
And ask you, basically get technical. So before the course, did you have any launch? I know we just kind of talked about it, but what did you do to launch your course in terms of, did you have some kind of like, I don't know, 3 weeks of promotion before you?
Oh my gosh, this was embarrassing. Okay. So I'll tell you a little story. I was completely out of money. I had almost entirely drained my bank accounts trying to get these stupid courses launched and finished. And like, I was so proud of them, but I was also so out of money. And so for the last 4 to 6 weeks leading up to the launch, I worked 12 to 16 hour days every single day. And there's a difference between thinking you're like hot shit because you're working very long hours and when you don't have any other option because you need to get this out and it needs to start making money so that you can eat. And so I was working so crazy hard and I did have in about the 3 weeks leading up to the launch, I had a small group of about 30 people from my newsletter pay kind of like half price for early access and providing a lot of feedback as I made my final changes to the courses. And that was very helpful. They were also kind of helpful for some of the promotion and, you know, having some quotes from customers and whatnot. But I wouldn't really call that too much of the promotional strategy. I would say that the Sketchmaster had to launch when Sketch was sending out a newsletter and it had to be in it. They were sending it out at, I don't know, like 6 a.m. San Francisco time. And I worked just nonstop through the night, just trying to get the last little pieces of the website or analytics connected or whatever. And there was actually like one video in the course in particular that I was rushing to finish that night. And so I had to launch it that morning. And I was so, so deeply exhausted that that after it launched, I really had no energy to do a whole lot of promotion that day. And I tried to like post it in a few places and then take a quick nap. And then so a few days after that, I was able to do, you know, post it in various places. And there was some buzz around it. But I say it was embarrassing because I just like Sketch basically launched it for me when they sent something out to their big newsletter. Mm-hmm. And I was so wiped out that I could barely even stay awake to post another thing on Twitter or Facebook. So, not recommended, partially or largely due to the kind of financial reality that I was in leading up to it. But, I would say that having a group of people test it beforehand was helpful, both for feedback and, you know, to get some people very excited about it before it launched. And, you know, I could have done a lot more. I could have lined up a number of interviews or podcasts or articles that kind of coincided with it. And a lot of that stuff had to come in the weeks following. But in retrospect, it wasn't that big a deal. Launching is important, but it's not make or break.
Well,
it's as important as what you do after.
And I think also one of the interesting things about your course is that it's available all the time, right? There's no, it's an evergreen course, essentially. There's no sort of start and end or different batches or different periods.
Yep. And it's not a subscription. It's just, it's kind of funny. Like I could probably make a lot more money by making it a subscription too. I'm just like a big believer in kind of doing something simple and making it as straightforward as possible. So you buy the course, you get it, you've always got access and I'll try to keep it up to date, period.
So I want to ask you about keeping it up to date. So how much are you going back and updating videos and lessons that you've already recorded? Because Sketch is constantly making updates, or are you just making improvements?
Yeah, all the time, both for feature updates that Sketch is making. So for example, right before I launched the courses, they had that big update where they completely changed how symbols work. And I had to spend a few days going back, changing the scripts, re-recording audio, adding whole new sections to the courses. And given my process where you've got this, like, you know, 1 or 2 hour long course that builds a real world project and every section builds upon itself, like, it's all workflow related. So a new feature can very much disrupt that workflow or change that workflow or add a whole new workflow. And it is particularly time consuming given how I've made the courses to make those updates. But that's been something that I make sure to do and hope that I can continue doing that for quite some time. And I also try to make improvements to the courses that I hear from customers. So they say, hey, you know, this worked for me, but I wish there was a way to do this maybe without a plugin. And so I'll think about a different workflow and try to reincorporate that back into the course. It's funny, without a subscription, I've tried not to make it an expectation that the courses will be updated, but I care a lot about it. And I want these to continue to be the best resource for people to learn how to use Sketch very professionally. So, you know, it's just something that I kind of like, I feel like I owe it to my customers. I really care about every single person who buys it. I see all of those purchases come in. And fortunately, it's making enough money that I can do that with part of my time.
Cool. That's amazing.
Now that Sketch is releasing new features like every 8 weeks, it definitely means that I have to frequently update the videos.
So how do you do it? Like, technically, how do you go and back and update the videos?
You know, some people make tutorial videos by just turning on their webcam and talking for an hour. Mm-hmm. And those can be useful, but I knew that wasn't what I wanted to do. I wanted something that was really professionally made, had great production quality, and that every single thing that I said was well thought out, and that I always knew I was being very efficient with people's time. So there's, you know, the amount of material in a 1 hour course that I've made is equivalent to like a 2 or 3 hour course somewhere else. Mm-hmm. I write the scripts while I kind of design a project that is going to require all of the features and workflows that I want to train people on. Mm-hmm. And then I reconstruct that project while writing a script in my own words, like very natural language. And then I record it on this very microphone that I'm talking on right now and have an audio editor cut together the best takes and make it into a seamless audio track. I then listen to that audio track while I record the screen recordings so that I can speed up my typing or kind of cut that together separately from the audio into a very seamless finished piece that seems like it was just perfectly recorded the first time around. Mm-hmm. And then I also add motion graphics and animations and a little bit of live action video kind of introducing the courses. So they are very time consuming to create. And when I go back and change them, I'm just always crossing my fingers that it's something that I can just maybe re-record a little bit of the audio. But increasingly, I have to maybe make a dramatic change to the script and re-record 1 or 2 sections.
Yeah.
Which takes several days.
Yeah. So it's a challenge, and also like with Sketch updating so often, so it is a big challenge, right?
Yeah, it is. You know,
it sounds like a painstaking process.
It is, but it's just so, it's like, it's the right way to do it. for this, you know, there are many different roles that tutorials can serve, but for me, I want these to be a very kind of linear, well-guided process of taking somebody to a better level of understanding. And because it's so guided, it cannot be like 2-minute videos just focusing on one feature and then another feature and then, oh, Sketch just made a new announcement, I'll just add another 2-minute video and boom, I'm done. Like, I expect that, you know, if I was watching these, I would expect that the workflows that I am being told are the best design workflows to use, that they are continually the best and the easiest and the most efficient, even after Sketch issues another little update.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's kind of the, I suppose it's like a lot of the other stuff that I've done. It's not the easiest way, but it's the way that I'm most proud of.
Yeah. And it's so after all this hard work, I really have to ask, how is it you managed to price so low?
Yeah, so it's interesting that you say that. I both agree and disagree because I wanted these courses to be accessible to a bunch of people. Mm-hmm. And I've played around with the prices a little bit. And when I increased them, my overall revenue went up a little bit, but I also noticed that I wasn't getting as many international purchases. Not as many people were buying the bundle of the courses, which I really feel like these first two courses were made for each other. They kind of cover the fundamentals in a very nice package. And I want people to really, I want people to get that information. I don't want them to feel like simply because the price of each course is a little higher that they need to learn less or that people around the world are suddenly priced out. And, you know, even at my lowest prices, I've had people in some parts of the world, like Turkey, just say, hey, your courses are way too expensive because of the exchange rate. And it's so funny. It's like they're just like some very specific cases where, you know, some people in some countries are just inevitably priced out. I try to help them a little bit when I can, and I offer student discounts. But, you know, I see these courses as part of a greater plan to release more and more and more courses. And I want, once I have 3, 4, 5, maybe more courses, I want people to feel comfortable just, you know, maybe buying a couple and then buying another once they're ready for it and not needing these to be huge decisions. Like I said before, this is making enough money to keep itself going, to sustain me. And as long as it does that, then I don't think I'll need to raise the prices. I ultimately created this so that the digital design world could be very well trained on this tool. And I'm not trying to profitize off of that too much, so much as I am, you know, I just needed to make enough money to keep itself going and to keep me going.
That's awesome. That's awesome. And really nice to hear. Really like someone who truly, you know, loves their craft, values what they're making, is bringing value to a lot of people. Like, thank you, Peter. Really awesome to hear.
Yeah.
I'm feeling like I'm interviewing that Tori Hansel maker.
What? I don't understand the reference.
The Tori Hansel
story. You're not the only one.
Like, really? No, it's like Kill Bill. Come on. It's like a famous move.
Am I a cool action figure then?
No, you're the cool like crafts master who's like sitting and making samurai swords and making them so sharp and working like, and like you really care about the craft and you're working hard to because you want this craft to be the best and you really know your shit. I mean, really, you really know what you're doing and you have a mission and you're not trying to.
You're trying to help people and get the information out to them.
Yeah.
Well, thanks, guys. Yeah, I think I hopefully have a future making samurai swords.
It's the second course, right? That's the next one.
Yeah, surprise.
Well, on that note, I think we're pretty much reaching the end of our conversation here this time, but it's been awesome having you and thank you for taking the time to talk to us.
Absolutely.
I learned a lot today. And I want to ask you, so where can the listeners find you on the internet?
Yeah, so my personal website is pnowell.com. That's pnowell.com. You can also go to sketchmaster.com. That's where the courses are. And on Medium, you can either search for my name, Peter Nowell, or you can get a link to it from my website. So
cool. And we'll put all of those in show notes as well.
Oh, and I'm on Twitter sometimes. Sometimes I'm on Twitter. P. Nowell Design.
Cool. All right. Thanks a lot, Peter.
Thank you, guys.
Here, thanks so much. So, Peter, and one last thing. You said that you would like to give a discount for our readers, right?
Yeah. Readers and listeners, anybody who goes to sketchmaster.com/hackingUI through the end of October can get 15% off any of the courses.
Amazing. That's amazing. They're already like, you know, well,
they're already pretty cheap.
Or like No, I'm saying they're already worth so much more than what you know you take for them, and giving this discount, it's like amazing. If anyone like hearing this and working with Sketch and or considering working with Sketch, go there and buy those courses now. I'm not kidding.
Yeah. I've actually had a lot of people who are professional designers take the courses and tell me how many new tricks they learned, that they were surprised to learn. So even if you've got it down, check it out, and you might learn something.
That's awesome. Awesome, totally. All right, Peter, thanks so much, man. It was a pleasure having you. A pleasure meeting you also in San Francisco. I'm sure we'll keep in touch, and thanks so much.
Thanks so much,
guys. Good luck with the course and everything you're doing. Alright, so that's a wrap. Thank you, hackers, for joining us today. We hope you enjoyed the show. You can find all the links and resources from this conversation on hackingui.com/podcast. And just before we go, we want to share with you something that you might find useful.
As you know, we are voracious readers and consume a ton of articles, books, podcasts, and videos about design, development, and side projects. We curate the hell out of everything, and each week we send a short roundup email of our favorites. If that sounds like an email you'd enjoy getting, then we'd love to have you join our awesome community, which already has more than 20,000 happy members from all over the world. You can sign up on hackingui.com.
By the way, on hackingui.com, you'll also find some other cool stuff like the Side Project Accelerator, our 8-week online program in which we teach everything that we learned in the 3 years working and scaling Hacking UI as a side project before we quit our day jobs.
And you'll also find our resources page, which reached top of the week on Product Hunt Tech, and our events section, which is filled with conferences and meetups for designers and developers.
Hey, D, don't forget the tees, man. We also got some cool t-shirts for designers.
Sugi, again with the t-shirts?
Hey, I designed those, but really, last thing, if you enjoyed this, we would really love to hear from you, either by tweeting at us at HackingUI or by reviewing the podcast on iTunes. Those reviews really go a long way and help us and even make our day.
All right, we'll see you next week, hackers, and remember to keep hacking.